welcome to the program, in Douglas Edwards' new book about the early days of Google. He tells the story about how Larry Page recorded programs on NPR, and then when he had the opportunity, listened to them back at double speed so as to save time and use his time more efficiently. For many of us, we may not go quite that far, but we do spend a lot of time consuming and connected to a lot of different kinds of media. Is there a problem with this? Is concern about this akin to our grandparents telling our parents not to spend too much time listening to the radio, or our own parents horrified that their kids were putting on earphones to listen to rock and roll music on their transistor radios? Are those concerned about media consumption simply old school, who don't understand the world that digital natives live in? Or is there really a price to be paid for too much of a good thing? We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Dr. Thomas Cooper. He's an expert on media and culture. He's a professor of visual and media arts at Emerson College and the founder of the Association for Responsible Communication, which was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. He's a former assistant to Marshall McLuhan, who has taught at Harvard and other leading institutions. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Thomas Cooper to talk about his book, Fast Media, Media Fast. Tom Cooper, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. Great to be on board.
Are we really suffering from a kind of media overload today, or is it just something that we talk about a lot?
It's double-edged, yes and no. The yes is that our children are now spending 45 hours per week with media and only 17 hours with parents. So it's not just the amount, it's the ratio. They're only spending 30 hours in school, so media has become a primary teacher. We adults have 5 hours of TV per day plus 4 hours of internet, so we're often multitasking, and that means we may not be focused on at all what we're doing. There's also the concern about knowledge being replaced by quick fixes and sound bites, Wikipedia and so forth and so on. So there are a lot of dangers. The positives, I think, are well known. You have all cultures, all religions, all philosophies, all travel agents and so forth right at your fingertips. So the world suddenly shrinks, and we have the capacity to learn almost anything very quickly.
But is it, in a way, when we address this trying to put the genie back in the bottle, are we not better off trying to figure out how to cope better, how to process better in the world in which we're living today, as opposed to trying to go back or force ourselves back to a simpler way?
Absolutely. The book Fast Media, Media Fast is not about throwing out media, not about nostalgia
right.
for the past. It's about doing what Thoreau did in his day. He didn't throw out people. He went to Walden. He needed to transcend and come up with a perspective on all the gossip and conventional wisdom of his day that he felt was rather shallow and didn't give him personal insight. So today, we can't actually do that in the same way. Last time I was at Walden, two kids were trying to text each other. So it's a different world, but we can find the Walden within. And the book is totally about that. A media fast is right for some people and not for others. A media diet, which is customized to the individual, is right for some people. Or media reflection, simply thinking about what you're doing rather than doing it in an enslaved pattern, is good for yet other people. So in my classroom, I tend to divide students into three groups. They choose the group they want to be in to learn what they can learn about their relationship with media and change it. But it's not at all about going back to the 50s or, for that matter, becoming the Amish, even though we can learn from the Amish and vice versa.
Talk a little bit about these experiments that you do with your classes where, you know, one-third of them are on a fast, one-third of them are on a diet, and then you have your control group.
Absolutely. And by the way, I've done those experiments with other groups as well. We take media fast and diets with senior groups and civic groups. Families like to try this, churches, other groups. And so there's a whole chapter in the book about doing this collectively, classrooms being one example. In my own classes, it started 20 years ago at Emerson College, and I've learned a lot through trial and error, but it's basically become a process where students have a three-week experience of either cutting out all the guilty pleasure media in their life, not the practical media. If you need to see a safety tape on an airplane, see it. If another professor asks you to read a textbook, read it. But they cut out the guilty pleasure part of the media. And then the second group goes on a media diet, which means they may want to see only inspirational media or cut out Facebook for a while because that's their addiction, or add very interesting websites that they can learn from. Media diets customized to the individual. And the third group, the control group, keeps a diary of their media habits. So let's say every time they go in the car and they realize, whoops, I got to turn on the radio, or every time they go home and say, whoops, I got to pick up the remote, or every time they're in a restaurant and say, oh, I've got my handheld out again instead of talking to the person I'm with, they make a note of that. And then the three groups compare notes, they think out loud, they learn a lot. It isn't for everyone. There are a few students who have a hard time with it, especially initially, just like we would have withdrawal symptoms if we were to go on a food fast or a food diet, perhaps. But by the end of it, about 90% of them have a great experience one way or another. Some of them even want to take a full-fledged media fast in the summer when there's so much more to do.
And what part of it do they find to be the best part of the experience, those that have been on either a media diet or a media fast?
Right. Well, there are many things that you're saving. So for one, they find they're saving a lot of time that maybe they wanted to spend getting better grades or finding out who they are in life or taking up creative activities that they always wanted. So you save about 8 hours a day on the average, although for some people it's just an hour or two. Next, you save a lot of money. We used to spend just a few dollars a month on media. Can you remember those days? Now a family or household can spend $1,000 constantly getting new computers, new upgrades, better cable, you know, all of that stuff. You save yourself ultimately, too, because if you're a couch potato, you may die with, you know, watched 1,000 episodes of Survivor on your tombstone. Whereas if you're involved in some kind of personal wake-up call, you may decide you want on your tombstone made a difference or help find the cure for cancer or, you know, save three people's lives or pets for that matter, you know, rescue 20 dogs, whatever it might be that you feel in your life would give you purpose. You save your thinking as well. For example, I'll ask my students, how many have very strong opinions about, say, Obama? They'll all raise their hands. How many have strong opinions about, say, Lady Gaga or Bin Laden? They'll all raise their hands. Then I'll say, how many of you have actually spent 8 hours alone off camera with any of these people to see what they're like? None of them raise their hands. So they suddenly realize their thinking is all media controlled. They live in a fantasy world where they speak with very quick, loaded ammunition opinions about almost any topic without firsthand experience and without serious research. So their thinking also revives, and they're thinking about thinking. All of that is what's saved.
The other side of that, though, is that they are connected to the world, arguably, and have a mm-hmm. broader base of knowledge than mm-hmm. perhaps previous generations might have had.
Absolutely. There's a whole chapter in there on the Amish and other groups that have no media and what you lose by not having media, as well as what you gain. For example, if you're in an intentional community like the Amish or many other groups that don't have media, and there's a nuclear meltdown 5 miles away, wouldn't it be much wiser to have the media? Or for that matter, if a hurricane's coming or a blizzard, you want to know precisely how to prepare and what you can do. So the media has many positive advantages. On the other hand, living in an Amish community, I might walk into a family and hear them all singing together or hear them laughing on the floor playing some kind of board game or something. Whereas when I walk into a typical suburban family, there may be one door where there's a lot of music pouring out from MTV, another door that's completely closed because someone's got their porn addiction working, which is about a quarter of the population who consume media these days, ingest a fair bit of porn. Another door may reveal an argument going on between two people, and another one is sports, nothing but sports. And so we have a very segmented set of subcultures that we live in that are very media-driven in this society, even though there are lots of exceptions to that. And in a no-media society, there may be a totally different set of cultural advantages as well as disadvantages.
Talk a little bit about understanding and understanding how to interpret the media that comes at us, because that's a big part of this as well.
Absolutely. One of the interesting things I found in the research I did is that we have something like a 10-to-1 ratio of learning from the media rather than learning about the media. So most of us don't know how to interpret, especially children. They see ads for products and don't know the downside, don't know false advertising. So we have actually very little interpretation of media in our society relative to the consumption itself and relative to the, quote, knowledge that we get from media, such as how Lady Gaga is or Michelle Obama or anything else. So we actually need a far, far greater change in the ratio there of media literacy, media education, people actually taking courses about how the media works, you know, the way that it mythifies and serializes and often deceives and primarily gives us a message of something's wrong with you, buy something. That's the number one message of mass media. Now, I'm not a media basher. You're doing a great thing here. You're talking about ideas. You're getting people to think. You're actually asking us to reflect upon what goes on. So I'm not suggesting the media can't have a wonderful, positive, uplifting, sometimes spiritual, sometimes aesthetic, sometimes educational role in our society. It often does. It's the slash, flash, trash for cash syndrome that continues to grow that asks us not to think and simply to consume that I'm concerned about.
Is it simply the speed at which and the quantity at which this information is coming at us today? I mean, certainly media in some form or another, whether it's, you know, newspapers on parchment or traditional newspapers or whatever, or radio, whatever it might have been, media has been with us for a long time in some form. What's different today is the sheer quantity and the speed at which it's coming at us.
Absolutely. There's an entire chapter in the book on speed up, as well as keep up, as well as blow up, which means the increasing size of your entertainment center and everything else. And speed up certainly has related effects. One of them, a man named Richard Werman, has written a best-selling book about called Information Anxiety, this kind of subconscious concern that especially white-collar, but everyone feels that I'll never be able to adapt to all the platforms, get all the upgrades, have the new latest handheld, learn everything I need to learn in time, let alone process all of my tweets, faxes, voicemails, emails, 1,000 channels that are coming at me. So that subtaste of information anxiety is growing in our society, and that's different than 200 years ago.
And where the difference is in large measure is that from a biological evolutionary perspective, we are simply not designed to deal with the kind of information overload that we're experiencing today.
Absolutely. Our brain is designed to process in very different sorts of ways. One of the reasons we're not aware of what we do to ourselves is we fail to test technologies anymore to any kind of extensive consumer protection way before they go on the marketplace. We hear about getting cancer from cell phones after the fact, whether or not that's true. We hear about women having radiation poisoning for their embryos when they sit in front of computer screens for hours on end after the fact. We hear about carpal tunnel syndrome being related to keyboards. These are not things that we think about comprehensively with experts, with people who are primary stakeholders like parents and so forth, until after they're on the marketplace. We test for marketing. We want to know if they'll sell. We don't test for safety. So by virtue of that, we have a lot of hidden effects that come along after that we should have studied beforehand. And that means our society is speeding up far too quickly. We're introducing far too much before we understand what impact it might have.
Another area that you talk about is the impact that all of this has on creativity, that how much of what is out there is simply regurgitated in some form, and that affects how we think, how we process information, and ultimately creativity.
Absolutely. If I wake up singing I'm a Material Girl, which is a Madonna song from 20 years ago, or even a more recent song like Teenage Dream by Katy Perry, I'm clearly neither one of those things. My thinking is coming intravenously from some other source, and I'm choosing instead to balance my bank budget or whatever else. But this is what's coming into my, I don't need that in my head. I didn't deliberately put it in my head, and I probably don't want 1,000 jingles from ads swimming around in my head. So our thinking has been, if you want to call it polluted, or certainly densely packed with a lot of miscellaneous and often irrelevant and sometimes even damaging information. For example, children see 200,000 acts of violence before they're 18 years old. So to have all that recycling in your consciousness can't be too healthy either. So all of that changes our thinking pattern considerably, and the question is original thought possible anymore? And what do we mean by original thinking? And that's something I like to pose not only to my students but my colleagues and I hope society at large. Don't we want to be thinking more creatively?
And yet we see a great deal of creativity. I mean, Silicon Valley, for example, where we have digital natives, lots of young people that grew up on all of the kind of media that we're talking about and all of the kind of multitasking that we're talking about, who are proving day in and day out that they're capable of creative thought.
And that's absolutely the double edge that I was talking to you about before. If you're identified with being the creator, you can use media in all kinds of fresh, original, you know, kind of provocative ways that force greater thought, that allow people to feel creative and so forth. But if you're identified with the consumer, it's just another drug, another addiction. So there's an entire chapter in the book on whether you're the creator or the consumer. I've had media producers and others take a media fast and come back and be far more creative after the media fast because they're not overstimulated anymore. It's just like a great vacation. They feel their brain is awakened. So you can use the media in extremely creative ways. It's not the enemy. But if you use it the way that a drug-addicted person uses a drug, it becomes the enemy because all you are is the sum total of what you've consumed. I'm interested in who's beneath the programming and how we break people free from all that programming that tells us I'm a material girl.
But this is the interesting part about it as it relates to a historical perspective, which is that it used to be consuming media, whether it was television, radio, what have you, was in some way the vacation itself. That was the escape. That was the relaxation from everything else in the world. Now it's the thing that we need to have a vacation or an escape from.
Good observation. So there's nothing wrong with using media therapeutically. All of us have our guilty pleasures. All of us, after a long day of work or whatever else, may have something that hits the spot the way a particular drink hits the spot, but it's when you continue to drink that particular drink excessively, even in Napa Valley, that you begin to notice an imbalance and then a lack of focus and then perhaps unemployment and then alienating the people around you. And that's where the danger is when it's done in excess. For example, if you talk to enough divorce lawyers, they'll tell you that media preoccupation is becoming a greater and greater factor in the divorce rate. More and more people say he was watching porn all the time rather than being with me, or he was only interested in sports every night when he got home, or she was always on email and said couldn't talk to me or couldn't talk till the commercial. And so that's just spousal. But if you look at children and parents, there's so many parents, grandparents say, I can't understand my child anymore, or my child won't even talk to me anymore. They're addicted to this video game or whatever else it is. And the video game may not be particularly healthy for their thought. So it's changing our relationships. It's not just a matter of whether the media is good or bad or whatever. It's the dosage. And as you increase the dosage, and as you know, if you study addiction, you have to increase the dosage, then over time the person becomes living in a world of their own rather than the real world where they need to have friends, family, strong bonding, and the ability to succeed. You can't do that if you're living in a cocoon and if you're being controlled by an electronic womb.
What happens then as this goes further and further, as we have generation after generation now of digital natives who grew up knowing nothing else, that this is the baseline?
Again, if they're balanced and if they're creating, then I don't see the problem. The problem is not with digital. The problem is with assuming that Wikipedia is knowledge rather than going through the test and making sure that you check other websites that are more carefully researched by a series of people, many of whom are experts and so forth and so on. I don't see the challenge any more than there was a challenge when we went to print or when we went to radio or being a TV culture. All of those brought pros and cons. The challenge is now obsession. We're so fixated upon this that a person who doesn't use the latest this or that is often ostracized. So I think we need to return to a climate of balance and a climate of coming from the inside out being far more important than simply being a pincushion for everything that comes from the outside in.
Is there a point that it is also, though, inspirational? I mean, we see in some quarters, at least, a shift in the culture where we are moving from simply consumerism in some respects to a more experiential culture, people wanting to do things as opposed to just buy things. And much of the inspiration for that comes from things people have seen or visited or experienced in some virtual way in that media world.
Absolutely. We could have yet another interview about all the inspirational, educational, wake-up, creative, intellectual, positively aesthetic aspects of media. Many people have had their lives changed by a book they've read, a movie they've seen, some kind of sermon on TV if they're religious. I mean, all kind of an inspirational speaker if they're not. All kinds of creative catalysts have awakened people to their next level of growth or to another whole way of seeing things by virtue of the media. Even in universities now, people use a lot more visual and digital media than they use books, which isn't to say there's anything right or wrong with any of them. So all of that is important in a positive way. The problem is when you no longer know who you are, because the sum total of what's in your head was, I'll use the metaphor, intravenously, almost brainwashed into you in ways that you can't tell are you or not. Do you know the old story about the guru at the beginning in the front of the room saying to all his disciples, you are all free thinkers? And they all nod and say, we are all free thinkers. That's the danger of the media. It constantly teaches you you're independent, creative, and so forth, and then you regurgitate exactly what it told you.
Right. And yet the irony is that because of the nature of it today, we're supposed to have more control over it. We're not forced to sit in front of that television or in front of anything else when they want us to. We can do it when we want to. That's supposed to be a positive side of it.
That's the ideal. But let's look at the numbers. In the last 30 years, overall media consumption has gone up by 350%. In our lifetime, we will see 3 years of television advertising alone. Now, you may say people choose that, but I beg to differ with the research showing that a lot of these become mindless habits, and we forget about what's going on. Then we go into a shopping center to buy two products, and we emerge with 17, five of which we've just seen advertising for. So I think there are a lot of hidden effects. We like to think we're free, but the whole point of a media fast or a media diet is for us to actually see if we are free, and if we're not, to find ways to become liberated.
When you talk about the subject with your students who have grown up with all of this, how do they respond? How do they look at it?
Well, many students continue to write me back and say, you know, that media fast you had me on, that was the best thing I've ever done. Now, I assume that some don't write me back because it wasn't. And so you have to stay balanced about and humble as well. It's not for everyone, and I've had a few critics, although I've had a lot more, I guess you'll call it fans. I don't know if that's the right word, but people who want to use their minds in fresh, awakened ways throughout life and not be controlled by anything intellectually, not just by the media, but by political theory or rhetoric or dogma, are a belief system that basically they can't resonate with and so forth. No one wants to be controlled. And so I think the majority of students would say if they were interviewed, and I hear from a lot of them, at the holidays they'll send a holiday card or whatever, they'll often send an email and say, you know, you made me think about this in a way I had never, ever considered. And in fact, I am using the media now. I'm a producer here. I'm a director there. I'm a scriptwriter there. But I'm doing it thoughtfully rather than blindly.
Are we going to get to a point where there is just inherently more balance by virtue of the fact that so much of what we're talking about, so much of what we're seeing, is still new? There's still a novelty aspect to a lot of this, particularly the degree to which we have this huge number of choices and there's so much coming at us. That novelty arguably at some point wears off, and there's a more mature phase that we enter into.
Absolutely. The creative aspect is constantly inspiring us. We have new synapses made by the brain. I'm an NPR fan and many other things myself, and I often hear what I've never heard before. And so I think there's a whole lot out there that we can be very thankful for, that we're blessed to have, that our great-grandparents would have been relieved to have from all their boredom of doing the same task over and over again. All of that's great. But I don't think we should kid ourselves that there are no negative effects. We shouldn't be studying this. We shouldn't be aware of our own individual consumption, because when it becomes addictive, it works by a different set of rules than when it's an elective in our society. And the addiction is so profound now, we have addiction centers, including one in the state where I am, Massachusetts. I read about one in Taiwan recently. But even way back in the 1970s, there was an NPR show put out about Television Anonymous, people who could not go to sleep at 11 or 12, but at 4 or 5 still found themselves grazing with their remote, knowing that they had a job at 7 o'clock the next day, and they'd probably lose it after 5 nights like this. So that's my concern. When it becomes an addiction, when you can't take it or leave it, it has a profound impact on your relationships, on the economy, the environment, the workforce, society itself, violence in society, lots of other things. In fact, do you have a minute for me to read you a paragraph about the extreme nature of it?
Sure.
If you put all of the studies together about children and the impact of entertainment media, not all media, but just entertainment media, in the last 20 years, these are all the serious studies. I've just been reading them. This is my one-sentence summary of what they say. The greater the excessive consumption of mainstream entertainment media, the higher the odds that an individual child will become obese, ADD, alcohol or tobacco dependent, academically mediocre or poor, housebound, prematurely sexually active or pregnant, violent, or and distant, if not alienated from parents and peers. Now, clearly, I'm a scholar, and I want to make sure that there are exceptions to this and that people know this is about excessive consumption, not normal consumption or subnormal consumption. But given the increase in excessive consumption and the numbers I've read you previously, where will society go if this is the trend?
Is the fault, though, in the media or in ourselves?
We've always tended toward excess. Human beings and human nature obviously have a record of excessive violence, a record of excessive consumption of all kinds of things. So it is partly in ourselves. But once we make devices that make it easier for human nature to flourish, you have to say the devices are somewhat anthropomorphic. We create them both for our best and our worst aspects. They mirror what's healthy and wonderful in our society, but they also give us an easy out when we don't want to face responsibility, when we don't want to do the right thing. They give us a nice, insular, narcissistic surround, a kind of mirror that's a vain mirror that shows us all kinds of positives without helping us really get to the core of what we need to do as individuals, whether it's to fix a broken relationship, whether it's to get our job or our lives back in order. They instead give us a narcissist narcosis, we might say, where we're numbed by so much entertainment that we don't wake up to what we have to do. And if you look at that on the global level, there's the question environmentally, if that's not the state we're in, too. Are we fiddling while Rome burns? Are we going down on the Titanic watching the next episode of As the Stomach Turns? What should we be doing about the world situation?
Thomas Cooper, the book is Fast Media, Media Fast, How to Clear Your Mind and Invigorate Your Life in an Age of Media Overload. Tom, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
I really appreciate it. You asked just the right questions, and you're an example of using the media as a wake-up call. Thanks for that.
Thank you, Tom.